We are here at the You Must Be Joking podcast again. It's another episode with myself, Eric Lawler, and
Will Arwoy.
And today we are very honoured and very excited to have, let's be honest, a national treasure in our presence. I know he's looking over there and he's churning, he's nearly getting sick in his own mouth.
It is the worst term.
You've said that intro to everybody that's come on to this.
I didn't say that about Joe Dowling. I didn't say that about Joe Dowling. I didn't. Don't mind him, Oliver. I haven't. I've given the game away. Our guest today is
none other than
the wonderful Oliver Callan. Oliver.
Well, I'm very impressed you do all of this without a script, actually.
Yeah, off the bat. Yeah, it's the way I did Fair City.
Why it's so manic.
We just go to the doctor when we get out here and get the script.
Sorry, does Fair City use a script?
It's a live
for the medication that they're on.
So Oliver Callan, you're in the studio here with us today. And as I said, it's brilliant to have you. Like I know you cringe at the fact that I said you're a national
very
institution,
cringy.
But let's be honest, like, you're one of the most famous people in the country, Oliver. You are. Whether you like it or not, your voice, your face, everything about you.
And it's gas because the real famous ones like yourself always just play it down, Mick.
Is it because, just because I started doing my own radio show for the first time 6 or 7 months ago, I don't know if anyone really noticed me before that.
No, I don't know about that. I've
appeared every now and again, sort of like a...
As a guest.
There's the odd spike, and then I disappear.
Yeah. Oh, so that's that fella. That's that fella behind all the
row here. Yeah. And then, do you
know what I mean? I've been very aware of you for a very long time, right back to the early days. It's the Jerry Ryan Knob Nation Saturday Night Show, stuff. Yeah. Like, so I was always well aware that you... And I had this conversation with my son the other day. When you listen to a radio presenter, and then you see a picture of them and you go, oh my God, that is nothing like I expected. Yeah, yeah. Like, you know what I mean? And we were having that conversation and I think that's probably what I did with yourself. I said, I have to find out who this Oliver Callan, I think you might have been in the paper at one stage, and I was like, that's Oliver Callan. I remember thinking you were very young. You look very young.
Yeah, I was in my 20s and I started working for Jerry Ryan Show, and I always wanted to work in the Jerry Ryan Show. Although there was no idea in my head how I could get there. Do you know what I mean? It sort of happened by accident at the end. And I think it was 2007. I only worked there for 3 years before he died. I basically killed Jerry Ryan. he died.
We didn't want to get into that.
But thankfully the inquest didn't notice.
So about those allegations, Oliver.
Let's get them out of the way before we start, yeah.
So I was in my 20s, and actually it's interesting, Jerry in that time was kind of saying, your best call it something that doesn't have your name on it, because if people find out it's just a bloke in a room yelling on his own, then it's kind of lose the attraction. And I think it's quite interesting how things have changed over the years, that... I think people prefer to hear that it's just one guy in a room.
Yeah.
Whereas he was dead right at the time, and it's like, you're right, I'll just make sure people think it's a whole coterie, a team of people all doing millions of things all of the time, and we just have a small snapshot of it that he's kind of snuck in for 3 minutes after 10. And Jerry Ryan used to it kind of like worked because Jerry hosted it, you know, after 10 o'clock news. He would do this enormous intro in a very Jerry way. It is going to be the thing that happened yesterday that we're all shiting ourselves about. What will the nobs make of it? We are into a nob nation. And it was like, okay, this better be kind of live up to this.
You're bringing me back there, Oliver.
Nearly 1,000 episodes.
Well, it was, wasn't
it? Yeah, and the reason I know that, and I'm not sure to say, I've done a Wikipedia on you today.
Today?
I did, today. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to lie. I'm not in the business of lying.
And if it's on Wikipedia.
Usually when I lied before, I ended up in prison, so I'm not lying anymore. Not that I'm thinking someone's going to come in the media and go, right, give us your hand.
The media police.
We're going to cuff you. Yeah. No, but that blew me away. I was going, nearly 1,000 episodes. I mean, the walk... And you know, the writing and the format and everything that goes into that. I mean, Jesus Christ, Oliver.
Oliver, you said Jerry Ryan was like a hero of yours almost at the start. And you were I'd love to go and walk with him. So how did it all come about?
It's funny. And when I was thinking of Jerry Ryan, I remember listening to him in the summer of late 90s when I was still living at home in Monaghan, and I had to kind of do the farming myself, more or less. The only thing I want in life is the credit for doing most of the farming on my own in the end, because I was the third child of four.
Right.
And they all claimed they did the work, my older brother and sister, but they fecked off because there was a younger fella to take over. Anyway, listen to Jerry Ryan washing out the milk tank every day. And then just a couple of years later, you're kind of working there. In your head, you're sort of like, wow, I'm here. But also, isn't Ireland kind of small?
Yeah.
It's all a little bit disappointing that there's nothing, there's no magical universe at the end that kind of runs things. And it was very hard work, I remember, because I didn't really know what I was doing. You had to turn out a sketch every day.
I'll tell you what's haunting about the Bleeding Dirty there for a minute.
That also is hard work, yeah. But this was late at night because I couldn't get studio time in RTÉ at the time. We were a very, very small outfit, basically, and I used Pro Tools, and none of the arcane technology would tackle that. So you could only use one computer in the building, in the whole campus, and that would be booked out by Radio Na Gaeltacht or something like that. And sometimes you wouldn't get to start at 10 o'clock at night. Yeah. So I did go slightly mad recording things, you know, right up to 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, I studied journalism at DCU, which all the journalists who listen will be going, you can't study journalism, you dick.
Yeah.
Which is true in a way, you have to do it. But there's kind of like, there was a nice course in DCU where you got to kind of think about it for a couple of years.
And where did you stay when you were going to DCU? You
don't want to actually in what they called Glasnevin Road, off Glasnevin Road, Ballymun Road, Glasnevin Avenue, sorry.
Yes, I know.
And I was across the road, St. Canice's Road.
Directly across the road from
DCU. And I wasn't allowed to stay there at the weekends, so I had to come home and do the farming to earn the 55 quid, which was my digs rent.
Wow.
Can you believe it?
Wow.
1999, year 2000. Of course, yeah.
It was like,
I can have enough money to buy my JD and Coke in the slipper.
I used to drink the slipper. Lads.
The slipper.
Yes.
Great place, wasn't it? Great place.
And the chipper was great. I mean, mate's family owned the chipper on the corner as well. And the Aberdeen Chinese was gorgeous.
Oh my God. Yeah,
really
the Chinese
good Chinese.
Definitely, the Chinese is definitely beyond reach of the student budget.
So 55 quid was 55 quid.
They were building the Helix and all the exciting buildings that are in DCU now, but we were just there for the building site. We were there for the end of the kind of... And also when I look at it, I probably ended up in DCU because it was the bit of Dublin closest to Monaghan.
Of course. It's just
and the buses served it, and it was full of Monaghan people. And it bizarrely was the only person, I think, from the entire town of Carrickmacross, where I would have went to secondary school, that ended up in DCU. So the north side was kind of like my home for certainly the first 10 years in Dublin. And I rented there, and then I kind of flipped south side for a bit and went, oh, there's a whole other bit of Dublin here to be ripped off in.
More than the north side.
And I was so excited when I came to Dublin. I literally bought the A to Z street atlas of Dublin to learn the streets, so I knew it, because I didn't want to feel like a tourist.
Right.
You know, I needed to fit in, change the accent, all the usual things that no one else does except me. And like, I get on the number 11 or 13 and I'm looking for, because you had to say in the name of the place you were
going
to.
Yeah, yeah.
And the bus are going to Dollier Street. And then it's what? Where? And he's like, making a shit. Dollier. Am I not saying it French enough? Dollier. And he's like, oh, Dollier Street. Yeah, there it was. Yeah, yeah.
Terrorist.
And they're the kind of traumatic incidents that stay with you your whole life.
What a bus to tour then.
Yeah.
And
great
it is
track.
Unlucky for some, isn't
Poppin',
it?
Poppin' Tree.
Yeah, Poppin' Tree. I live in Poppin' Tree.
It sounds like a lovely English place.
Yeah, it does.
But so do those places in Darndale, you know.
Buttercup
Grove.
But there were better naming places in those days than in the Celtic Tiger, where it's like, well, we'll just name things after whatever we demolished to get out. Sycamore Grove.
Yeah.
You know, and there was, what used to be here.
Like Black Rock sounds like a rough place.
Yeah, it does actually.
A lot of mad out there in Black Rock.
And yet all the Black Rocks in the country, are there about four, are all the posh bits of everywhere they are.
Dundalk. Yeah,
Black
Dundalk
Rock
as well, yeah.
There's one Athlone in Hamilton Roscommon.
And there's places like Cherry Orchard. Fucking body frame, mad place.
Remember the Cherry Orchard Riots?
I don't remember that.
Well, I remember it.
Well,
not
you
that
what
I was in the thick of it.
What year is that now?
That was, I think it was.
Was it over?
It just
was Apple.
No, Granny Smith ran amok. She did. No, it was one Halloween. There was murder in the place.
Cherry Orchard Riots.
And they wrecked it.
I'm like, definitely
literally
googling that after this.
Googling it.
You
Cherry
would be
Orchard,
great historian. When did that happen? One Halloween.
Yeah. Imagine doing the Cherry Orchard walking tour. This is where Anto started throwing rocks.
and Desi took great umbrage over here.
And Garrett Seamus and Fergal come round that corner and were met with a barrage of abuse and a bang of a rock in the face.
Actually, one of my most memorable days as a journalist were the riots, which were 20 years ago, actually. 2004, I think, is when they expanded the EU. Ireland had the EU presidency. And we were preparing for the anarchist riots, which were... They started a march in O'Connell Street, and they were marching all the way to Farmley through by the Navan Road and everything. And the journalists all set off from there. there. We were kind of going, lovely, there's going to be, we are guaranteed a riot. And something like that, we had no water cans, had to borrow a water cannon from the PSNI. And it took all day for the riots to finally kick off. And like, we're there going,
two fellas fighting.
Double shift. Yeah. And also, I'm on the Navan Road. There are no buses running after this. I have to get the way back into Today FM, as it was at the time, to get the actuality, as we called anything we recorded on the street. And it was great crack. And even the trials for some of the Reclaim the Streets anarchy movements, which were big in the Celtic Tiger era, you know, they happened 2 years later. And you're going, where is the fellow with the dreadlocks doing now who wanted to just end capitalism and have anarchy? Oh, he's working for the Bank of Scotland, Ireland.
In charge of mortgages. Yeah.
Even that alone was the Bank of Ireland, Bank of Scotland opening a branch in Ireland. We realised, well, there's already a Bank of Ireland. So we go, Bank of Scotland, Ireland. And like, nobody blinks, you know, they sponsored rugby teams and everything, Bank of Scotland, Ireland.
Like, so, come here, tell me, when you were in DCU, and then you were at home as well at the weekends. You obviously weren't listening to Jerry at the weekends because he was on Monday to Friday.
That's right.
So, when you were listening to Jerry, he made a big impression on you. So, you were doing recordings. So, how, You're brilliant at impressions, right? That's your top trade.
How did you realise you had that gift?
How did you, like, what were you doing? How did all that?
I just kind of wonder why no one else, why everyone doesn't do impressions. Because, like, we're obviously born, we learn our language and our accent from whoever is kind of strongest in your life. It tends to be your parents. Mm. If your parents have a different accent to everyone in the area, then your accent tends to change. You go to school and so on. So I was kind of going, I could do everyone's accent. My mother was from Cork. Dad is from Monaghan. Big, thick, you know, proper, big, you know, vowels as broad as fields in Monaghan. Yeah. Monaghan, like. And we were, my mother is from Cork, from East Cork, where they kind of start talking about like this and then they end up really high at the end of the sentence. And I had cousins from Newry and I had cousins from London. So I was just always kind of making fun of them and their bizarre accents. And as a result, I ended up with kind of no accent myself. Right. No, it's a sad moment. But
in between all the accents, aren't you?
I don't really know who I am anymore. And at school, I was kind of doing bizarre impressions like Michael Burke. He used to read the news, or he used to do a show called 999 in the 90s. Remember, it was all
and
the
Michael
kind of,
Burke, wasn't he famous during the Ethiopian stuff as well when that first happened?
That is not my memory of it, but
well,
yeah, he was.
I just remember
he was a big news
reporter with Live Aid and all the terrible stuff.
That's that, yeah.
Michael Burke, yeah, I remember him vividly.
Your memories are very negative, aren't they?
Yeah, I know, yeah.
So, who was the last big newsreader that just retired recently? What was his name?
Brian Dobson, of course. Yes,
Dobbo.
Yes, he was a character I developed whilst in Today FM, like the guy with the braces and everything, wonderful voice. Yeah. And we kind of, in the Callan Skicks show, we kind of looked for someone to be sort of voice of the nation where everything's kind of going to shit. And we landed on Dobbo because he's perfect, because he was doing the news so long, we've no idea really who he is.
You know? Yeah.
He's not allowed to have opinions, therefore he is clean of opinions. So we kind of turned him into a mad socialist, really, in many ways. Everything is broken, it's because of the capitalism system. But by all means, just go home and drink yourself silly with Centra wine. Just go back to sleep. Because Callan Skicks would have started in kind of crash austerity years when we were all very mad, but we just didn't do anything about it.
Yeah.
So they just angrily watch television and angrily drink with each other.
I have baby license.
Angrily emigrate.
So Callan Skicks, right, sorry, not Callan Skicks, Knob Nation started on Jerry Ryan. You did that for 3 years until Jerry died. Not saying you were implicated in his death by any means whatsoever. And for any of our younger listeners wondering who Jerry Ryan is, you might know his daughter, Lottie, who's still on the radio doing 2FM or whatever. But Jerry was an institution in Irish broadcasting. He had this really thick, velvety, cigar-soaked voice, didn't he?
And bizarrely, even though he was, you know, from a kind of a working class or semi-middle class background, because his dad was a dentist or a doctor or something, he seemed to cruise through his life boasting about how rich he was. He's the only Irish person. Yeah. Everyone else kind of plays it down if they have a few quid, you know, never pretending you've got to stay relatable. Whereas his relatability was like, no, he's actually quite happy talking about, I never turn right in a plane. I only turn left. Oh, I'm a bit under the weather this morning. It was at an Elton John party last night. And the rest of the show would be 3 hours of people, you know, phoning in hangover cures. Yeah. Never once saying, you're being paid a lot to do that job. You really shouldn't be hungover.
I often remember him talking about his afternoons in the Four Seasons after his show, sitting there with a big cigar, and I was with this. He was like, he didn't care that he was name dropping. He was naming all these celebrities and they were all there drinking. And normally,
we couldn't
as you
get
say,
enough of it.
Like we're very uncomfortable with people like that, particularly our own people. Like we're happy. We're not happy. We're comfortable with Americans and British people being full of confidence and talking about how good they are and who they know. But with Irish, it doesn't sit well. But like, for some reason,
you had a meal in a restaurant last night. It's the middle of the week.
Cheeky.
Not paying the license anymore for this. Yeah. I mean, it's a fantastic story. A crime reporter told me one time where he's out with Jerry Ryan that these people didn't set out for the day to meet each other. Crime journalist ends up with Jerry Ryan, he's coming off some other party. They all end up, and then these detectives come in who knows the crime reporter, and they're having a chat and everything. And then just in the middle of a funny story, Jerry grabs one of the detectives' guns and fires it into the ceiling.
Joking me.
And he's roaring laughing, everyone's scarpers, and you know, obviously the poor detective has to go back and write up a report on the discharge of a Garda weapon.
Oh my
and
god,
that I think was one of the many incredible, amazing Jerry Ryan
that's
stories.
Brilliant.
Not that, even told by Jerry Ryan,
but that would have been like, imagine that happening today.
Oh, imagine.
Oliver, like, oh,
oh
my
come
god
here, listen, that like, you've got the car, like
we get the books. Yeah. The works, like he'd be traveling on the streets.
It's, for starters, the other copper that has a gun on him, he'd be shooting you.
He's
gonna get shot.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? When you think about it,
wasn't that funny? Jerry Ryan go, here, gives a shot. And
I think he looked at
two
his
more brandies, please.
I think he was telling a story and he assumed, well, there's probably not loaded or there's a safety on, and then he's just looking up. Oh my god. This
oh yes, he was rock and roll, it's Jerry.
Packing heat.
He was rock and roll.
Do you see what I mean? So there's kind of like people are generally glad that society doesn't exist, and also it was a small little group of people as well who kind of held the opinions of the country in their hand. But there's a lot of me that misses it.
Yeah, 100%.
I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they rocked up to work hungover.
Is it a hard gig, Oliver? Like journalism, I know you look at the red tabs, the like your Mirror, your Star, your whatever, and then you've got obviously the Examiner, the Times, and these kind of what I would call the premiership of journalism
of newspapers.
Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Because
in this analogy, then honestly, where is the Sunday World? if they're not the Premier League,
the Sunday World, I think, has three journalists, three reporters. Like nearly every second story is with a fella two pages beforehand. Yeah. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Whereas obviously in the Times and that, it's a lot more varied. There's a lot more reporters. There's not just one fella telling you all about all the sports. There's different fellas talking about golf and racing or whatever it might be, you know.
And actually, the tabloids did all of the kind of heavy lifting on gangland crime in this country over the years. You know, they are looked down upon quite a lot.
Yeah.
But because they have to feed the particular beast and it has to be somewhat sensational, they tend to have to break more stories than the broadsheet media, who just kind of report what's going on and analyse what's just happened that you know about. But I talk to journalists now, they talk about the younger crop and how difficult it is to get them to learn that their stories, that the older guys and women used to get their stories just hanging out in pubs, and that was the hard slog. You wanted to go home, but you had to kind of wait around to meet somebody somewhere. Now,
so people had more contacts then and more moles.
They did, and were out and around. And just to meet that contact in between, they met somebody else and they just saw what was happening around the street. Whereas now there's a lot of working from home. A lot of it, journalists may not even leave their desk at any point. They're doing stuff on the phone or you search for someone. If you have a kind of a human interest story or something that's just happened as an incident, in order to track them down, you go on social media. You know, you don't. If something bad happens to someone, they used to call it the death knock, where obviously the papers wanted a photograph to humanise this terrible tragedy that's happened, a murder or an accident, and they would literally have to go and visit that family's home and sit down and chat, and they'd either be told to, you know, fuck off, or you know, they suddenly build up a rapport with them. Now you just trawl through social media, and because they published that image themselves before they've died, it's like it's public domain. So you don't need to get the photograph. I'm always amazed, and that used to be a learning thing for young journalists, going, you have to go out and do the death knock. Nobody would want to do.
No, my
Irish
God.
People, Oliver, on the whole, let's be honest, like, Oliver, like, Irish people are intrigued by death.
We've got
RIP.ie, like, I was telling people about this.
It's dunedeal.ie for the over 65.
I was telling people, you know, in England and different countries that we have a website that you can go on and see who's dead.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And even some of the news, the radio stations down the thing.
Oh, yeah.
The people who've died in the area. They tell you, you know.
The local death notices. Absolutely.
That still blows my mind, I have to say. I was listening to a regional radio station. We're doing a gig down in, you know, Tipperary there a while ago, and switched on, and they had a whole half hour section devoted to who died the previous week.
I mean, why didn't Dublin have this?
Because it'd take up the whole show. Well,
that's where they were missing. Yeah, there should have been Death Notice FM, where it was just all day long.
Yeah. You know? There's a gap in the market there. Death Notice FM. Yeah. R.E.P. FM.
Do you know the one that you know the signal that is that's Christmas FM and 8 Radio that has a roving community license? There you go now. There.
The six, welcome to the 6 o'clock Death Show. And our special guest is Rom Massey. Rom's in this week. He's had 17 customers in. Tell us all about them, Rom.
By the way, this would be a success.
I know. Can you imagine the people listening to it? Because it is. I mean, you go on to RIP. And I mean,
I'm just thinking of Dave McSavage doing the Joe Duffy thing. Just listening to that going, oh, yeah.
How did he die, Joe?
How close are you to death now, Betty?
We are intrigued. And I mean, look, it's
people ringing into the... Sorry, I'm going on with that idea. People ringing into the show. I hope to be featured on your show in the next couple of weeks. I got the bad news off the doctor today.
It's been my dream.
sorry.
Who puts the phone into funeral?
we digress again.
Yeah, but it is, and look, and as you talked about that death knock, and it's so personal when you think about it. Like, for a complete stranger, if you've lost someone by tragic circumstances, to have the bollocks to knock on your door and go, how are you? You know, away from the papers. Do you know what I mean? Can we come in and talk about my kind of being murdered?
Training as a young journalist was as a radio reporter going to lots of big criminal trials. Now, I used to envy the print journalists because they'd sit out there all day and they'd write their bit at the end. Whereas for radio, it's like, we'll have to go out because we've got to file a 40-second report somewhere with this incredibly complicated story for the 11 o'clock news, and on it goes through the day. But it was just, you kind of, like Catherine Nevin, I remember sitting in that trial and she was like a superstar of...
every day you wanted to see what you were.
Of our dark history. And that was the discussion, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And like they were talking about her fingernails dripping with blood and so on, and it was editorialising and nearly collapsed the trial in many cases. But it was just phenomenal to watch something that you had seen been sensationally covered in the news and in newspapers, and just the minutiae. You see the crime, the justice system at work, because you get a guard who go, you're sitting in the jury going, right, I know she's guilty. Going, here's the thing, here's the underwear we found or whatever. It's like, that's clearly, it's the under, there's blood on it, that's it, I'm ready to go. But the questions are, well, where did this come from? Who put that in the bag? Who's the person? Okay, and then we have to, thank you very much, you get the person who put it in the bag, and then we open the chain of evidence to show that I'm the person who sees this on the criminal side. I took a photograph. They're so slow. Because we kind of judge, don't we? We all decide the jury got that wrong.
Yeah.
The judge has made an absolute hogwash of that whole thing. I know exactly what happened because I've spent 5 minutes researching this thing. I mean, the excruciating detail. And I remember meeting a guy and he was saying, you're a journalist, aren't you? And I said, what are you doing here? And he says he was a farmer who was in a bitter war with his next door neighbour. And what they were, it was coming to court.
Of a land.
And he sat in on a trial and he said, this is terrifying. And I'm not going to, like, no amount. I'll cave in to the person I hate rather than come here. Because you can disintegrate in the box. You can come up going, I know everything and I'm going to... And suddenly the man with the wig is looking at you down the barrel of your eye lens. And
your soul.
Totally take your part,
Do you know what? For anyone that's in retirement or anything like that has just retired, what a great way to spend your day just going up to the circuit courts and going, right, what's in this case here? Because it's on the wall.
Yeah, you
outside,
go in.
And you're going...
It's like it's outside the cinema.
And they do. They do.
And you can just go up and sit there. And I'll tell you what, it's great agents. Conversation at the table.
You will learn so much about the country it's in an afternoon in the
It's something I've always wanted to do and never to do it.
Something that I done but didn't want to do.
Of course. Against your own wishes,
I represented myself one time. I sacked my solicitor and I got myself 9 months.
But what were you looking at? What were you looking at, Tree?
I was looking at getting off. It would have kept me solicitor. Oh, sorry, this is your honour.
And here we are saying things. I put it
to
you.
I hadn't got a clue what I was talking about.
I love it.
Yeah.
Enoch Burke, eat your heart out.
Telling you. He's back in again, isn't he?
Yeah.
He's in jail again right now. Yeah.
Come here. Enoch. Do you know what?
Enoch.
Enoch. Isn't everyone entitled to their opinion?
Yes.
Realistically.
For sure,
Right, okay. And I know this could be a rabbit hole that we could go down or whatever.
How many lawyers do you have working on this?
I was watching a video the other day of 4 guards coming to his father's house. Sorry, I'm dyslexic. 4 guards coming to his father's house.
Again.
And I'm kind of going, Will you just come on, for God's sake? Like,
and the guards do not want to be anywhere near this. No. You can see in their faces, kind of going, yeah. Oh my God, they're so...
And even when the last time we've seen him being arrested and took into the van, like the guards were, you could see that the guards were going, you know, we've just actually been sent here and we're doing our job. They'd no more interest in grabbing the poor man and throwing him into the back of the van. And I mean, like...
I'm amazed that because the court system and judges, guards, they've never seen anything like this. And they've faced, like, proper gangland leaders in court, you know, murders, the worst people. No one's ever behaved like this in the court. The shouting, roaring, the disruption and interruption, the total lack of logic, you know, constantly saying, I'm in jail because I won't use pronouns, going, no, you're not. That is not illegal. It is not illegal to misuse someone's pronoun.
Yeah,
and you know, there are injunctions, and there was a disciplinary process. You're suspended. They had an injunction to stop you going to school. You keep disobeying that, then you go to jail. And then you go to jail, it's not working, you're fined. And then they keep in and out of jail. And I don't understand why the system is so broken that the state is paying him as a teacher. Well, it's a private school, so maybe the private schools are all paid for, the teachers are funded by the state. So effectively the taxpayer is paying his wages in a job that he was kind of sacked from 2 years ago. And but he's also, he owes money to the state for fines for contempt of court, for breaching the injunction, and there's no way of collecting that fine.
Well, he stops. It's a never ending like you think about it, because he doesn't give a flying fiddlers. He's like, take me to prison.
Well, I imagine he does. I mean, I imagine it's pretty unpleasant. You've been in prison.
Yeah, yeah.
And particularly in his rationale, he feels he shouldn't be there.
Mm.
And like only you in this conversation knows what it's like to lose your freedom like
that.
Yeah,
of course, yeah. But I know, Oliver, from
personal... Oh, I got married.
I know from personal experience, and I think I've spoke about this before, that the onslaught of society and people that come in that are well-to-do that end up coming in for crimes. A prime example was the guy who was a TD, what was his name, that was killed in the car crash over in Russia.
Oh, Liam Lawler.
I was locked up with Liam Lawler. Really? On the landing, Liam Lawler was on. I was in the training unit.
It's extraordinary.
I was in the training unit on Glengariff Parade at the time, and I was detoxing from drugs. I was getting on the beginning of the journey of getting my life together. And what I didn't like about it was, is that when Liam Lawler came in, so when we were out in the yard, Liam Lawler was locked up. Yeah. And when we were locked up, Liam Lawler was out in the yard.
Totally,
so they switched
different.
The whole prison regime around Liam Lawler. And I just thought,
special
that
privilege.
Is completely wrong. Like,
yeah.
And don't get me wrong, no one, come here, there'd have been a bit of light-hearted, you know, banter or whatever. But I know from seeing people that come in, you know, for crimes that have never been to prison before, they are really, really looked after. And it's crazy in a way, because when you think about it, these people, you know, that are, you know, from affluent areas, really nice areas, and speak about people like, and I categorise myself probably saying us, you know, that are from smaller minorities and working class, rough areas that, you know, had no chance. A lot of us growing up are now the people that they put their trust in.
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? It's crazy. And they're always looked after. There's none of them put down. There's none of them beaten up. That there's an arm put around their shoulder and they made sure that they're all right.
Would you not, sorry, like for me watching prison films and all that and having an skewed vision of internment and all that, would they be not picked on? Well,
no,
as
no.
In like, you know, what's
no,
the thing?
It's
you
crazy.
Give me your, you know, your, the stuff you get from the grub shop.
No.
What's it called?
It's just like the tuck shop. The tuck shop, yeah. No, they don't. They really, they genuinely and sincerely don't look. They're looked after. They really are. It's mad.
Definitely
criminals,
not paying TV,
criminals and people that are crazy in society, and you know, because Mountjoy is a pick and mix of criminals. You've got everything from your murderer right down to your shoplifter or someone that hasn't paid
crime.
Tax and insurance on
the
a car.
TV license.
Exactly, whatever it might be. But I've never in the years that I've been inside in prison have seen anyone that has come in that has been treated really bad. They've all been looked after.
Oliver, let's jump to it, I suppose. The huge controversy with RTE over the last few years. Don't know if you heard about it. Huge controversy, right? There was flip-flops and all about
sick?
Barter accounts. Yeah. Flip-flops and barter accounts and all that. And then obviously Ryan was I suppose, removed. And you stepped into his shoes in
I
that.
I did, yeah.
You did. Like, how pressurised did you feel? Or did you feel any pressure at all?
Oh, God, yeah. It was the weirdest thing because I was kind of phoned in June, which would have been the day, when the hours before the statement, the famous statement was released, which said Ryan Tuberty and the secret payments and everything. And it was like, what are you doing tomorrow? Are you free to come in? I said, yeah, I am. It's June. I usually kind of have a nice, gentle summer anyway, because Cans Kicks is kind of autumn and spring, and I don't do so many gigs in the summer. And it was, yeah, but it almost sounded like somebody had died.
Right.
It was like, oh, they couldn't tell me, you know, where, why I'm coming on or whatever. So I found out, obviously, when the statement went, okay, wow, that's why he's not coming in there. But the first couple of days was, I assume he's, I'm going to be here for, I think it was a Thursday and Friday.
Yeah.
I can't remember the exact days, and he was due to come on next week, and then suddenly, like, you're doing it again next week. And then every day there were just more and more revelations, because it literally just started out as overpayments to Ryan Turbine, yeah, that weren't published, and then you got into the Toy Show, the musical, which I always thought was the bigger scandal, just for the sheer volume of, yeah, money involved. It was like 3 million, and the fact that someone could make that decision with no consequences for them and lose all of the, lose 2 million on it, and it was just, yeah, it was weird. And doing his show with his team, and they weren't sure what was going on, and everyone's kind of in RT suddenly, like, it was well reported that the staff were very angry with, yeah, Ryan Tuberty and management. So you're going in, what do I do here? So, and
I mean, it must have been difficult. How would you play,
yeah,
it?
Like, what was the tension when you went in?
You know, I presume all of the executives were going, well, I hope you don't mention the scandal on the very show, where the scandal,
the elephant in the room,
unfurled. I said, well, if I don't do it, that's going to be very weak altogether. Yeah. So I kind of did sort of awkward jibes for,
made
it,
light of a coin.
Well, yeah, it would have gone against everything you've stood for in your whole career, basically, attacking the establishment. You know what I mean? Like, people would have went, ah, no, come on, Oliver, yeah, you got to have a pop at it.
I also, because I've been doing so much Cans Kicks and covering so many cock-ups in so many state agencies and departments, this just felt like more of the same thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought the country did go completely mad. Or the country, I mean the media, the other media, who love kicking the shit out of RT, let's face it. They just covered it so much. And then the RT newsroom as well went so over the top in a feeling that, well, we must cover this properly or else we'll be seen to be lax on it. So they kind of like beat people over the head with it for so long that it went on and on and on, to the extent I think people were just pretty sick of it, and we're just hopefully someone gets to the bottom of it.
Yeah.
And there were reports and everything in the end, but they told us absolutely nothing new that we already found out pretty quickly,
yeah,
in June and July of last year. And like, we were talking about the OPW this week with the bicycle shed that cost €335,000. And like, it's not even a shed. We finally saw pictures of it. It's an overhang or like a canopy.
I can only fit 18 bikes.
I was walking.
And there was one bicycle parked in it, because nobody parks their bicycle.
I was actually walking in the dog today. My job does a lot of work for OPW.
He's a scaffolder.
So we're in it. Really? I'm actually in there in the morning as well. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It just felt like every other scandal.
Is it a magic bike shed? Is it like every 2 weeks you come out and there's a brand new bike there? Or like,
I love the explanation.
€360,000 for a bike shed.
It's very kind of straight face going, well, it involved a lot of steel, glass, and Irish granite. Irish granite. Oh, none of that cheap shite that comes from abroad. Yeah, like, you know, it's been handmade by baby's fingers, and that's why it costs €300,000. And it's just when it's not your money.
Yeah.
You know, even if that's a private business, and you know, there's chief executive looking around, okay, oh, we did a bike shelter this month. I see. Well, it's like, it costs how much? Who the hell signed off on that?
I know.
Why did they sign off on it? Probably being fired, at least being very seriously reprimanded.
Yeah.
And like, I read the other day a series of some of my favourite cock-ups by the OPW, which in the main is a decent organisation that looks after our state buildings very well, and they're involved in Culture Night and all that, so on. That's the bit, the preamble you have to do in Ortiz.
Yeah.
But the best of it is, somebody mismeasures the building that they rent at the Department of Health headquarters, literally with a trundle wheel thing that you go around, mismeasure it, which results in an overpayment of €10 million in rent. Do you know? And they also mismeasure another building in Galway, which results in €2 million overpayment. And it's like, there's no punishment, no accountability for any of that. So of course we're going to end up with €300,000.
Stevie Wonder Architects that were doing that,
yeah.
Was it?
Like, someone has a job of measuring buildings. You
know? And I always felt the whole way through it, it's good crack to make fun of the RT thing, but really this is just another symptom of how Irish we are at running things, and will there be any accountability and so on. And it was unfortunate because the one person who was sacked initially was the Director General, Dee Forbes, is sacked, but she's sacked about a week before she's due to retire. And you know, it's the worst thing that can happen to you in Ireland. You get paid for the people who actually left early. They got a better deal than Dee Forbes, because they got paid for the years they don't have to work. And it's like being sacked as a Premier League manager.
Yeah.
Like, I would just go in and be Premier League manager for a week. Yeah. Pay me out the 3 years. I don't do any of the work at all. I don't care. I'm never going to work again.
And I'm just thinking you're saying that. You can imagine them all in the canteen going, sacked in the morning.
Again.
Again. Sacked.
Well, the whole country was looking for somebody to be sacked. intact. And but in Ireland, that looks like you're retired early on full pension and you get a lump sum. And I'm going, that's not really a punishment. And that doesn't really mitigate against the same thing happening again in other similar organisations again and again.
Wouldn't happen in America.
No, it wouldn't happen in England. They're quite good at sacking people, actually, quite quickly.
Sacking people and giving them the benefits that go with getting sacked. It's like,
what's the point?
Well, it's a tree arena now. But I mean, no, but I'm saying, like, it's like...
That's the level we're at, Oliver.
Like, it's like... you could only wish of being sacked in a position like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
And as the weeks rolled on, Oliver, where you... They were obviously having conversations with them. They were going, look, this is looking like it might be a more permanent thing, or how did that...
No, actually, that didn't happen at all. I mean, I think I had booked my holidays because we were expecting Ryan to come back and do his show around the middle of August. And that's when the next shock happened, which was Kevin Backhurst announcing, you know, there is no contract and it's not being renewed. I think that means he was sacked, but they never use that language. And that was a huge shock. And then suddenly it was like, oh, well, this is interesting, but I'm still going on my holidays. I was also kind of going... Feck you, Ryan Torbridge, now I'm going to have to consider, do I go in for this job or not? And you don't know at that stage how quickly they'll decide, how quickly do you do? But it, as it ended up, it trundled on right till the right into January of the following year, probably because of all there were loads of reports still to come out and so on. So that was, it was just a bizarre time. I was also just very sick of the scandal as well. I think a lot of the country...
I think we all got battle weary from really it, didn't we?
Not another RT... thing. Some of it was great crack at times. I mean, the Oireachtas sittings were absolutely spectacular. Some of the best telly we'd seen for years.
Oh, we had a big television set up in the Joe studio just watching it live. It was like the World Cup.
Tell us now, when you worked for Cadbury's as a salesman, what were you selling? the greatest minds.
Yeah, and it's mad because the viewings on Fair City, when that was all going on, were just on the floor. Like, I mean, everyone was just... Eurectus was like the new drama on the television,
Remember Low TD? You there around Tumbly. We don't like you there. You come up there. You're saying people like you. You should come up around here now to Dundalk. They'll tell you what's going
on. They're all queuing up, aren't they? It's my turn.
And I think of all the things that happened to Ryan, which must have been pretty hellish somewhere.
Yeah, of course, man.
He looked like he was most upset about that suggestion that the people of Louth didn't like him anymore.
They literally hung him out to dry.
I've met Ryan a couple of times.
Yeah,
I've always found him to be nothing but a gentleman. You know, I mean, why wouldn't he be, I suppose? Mm. But no, he's always been nice and a gentleman. And like, obviously, you've known him, you know.
Yeah, well, I've been on his show and on the Late Late as well. Yeah. He was always very encouraging, a character for
supportive.
Us.
Supportive, yeah, that's right.
And also, I always wondered every time there was a hoo-ha when his salary was announced, I always wondered, why didn't RT just say, you know, the first half of the first ad break of the toy show pays his entire salary for the whole year?
Yeah.
Do you know, not to mention the sponsorship of his radio show and all everything that goes with it. But they were never very good at defending those kind of things. Mm. And also, I think if he hadn't left the Late Late Show, and I know people said, oh, he knew what was coming, he left the Late Late Show. Ironically, no, if he had not done that, it would have been, I think, nearly impossible to sack the host of the Late Late Show.
So,
because he tore up his own contract and he was in contract. That was the kind of thing. So it must have been an incredibly lonely time. But at the same time, I try to take a balanced view of things. Like, he shouldn't have accepted the money, and he should have paid back the 150,000 euro he got for doing absolutely nothing. And it was just really bizarre. And in the end, it was hard to believe anyone's story, anyone's version of events, you know, because RT's very tangled version of events. Why were they paying? It just never made any sense. They just pay him the amount. Then you have a row about it. You have to justify it. But the kind of, why would D Forbes have been involved in this? I don't understand the scandal or why.
I mean, even accounts, it goes into that. Like, I mean, surely someone who's in the accounts department is looking, like, it's 150 grand. Mm. It's not 150 euros, surely the J's is like, you got
to
be looking.
I did think this big mistake, Ryan, and again, to be balanced on it, because he was always a decent guy and I liked him. And I liked his show as well.
Yeah.
I think his first statement, and you are always remembered, it sets the tone for everything in a scandal. And for someone who is a student of scandal, because he loves politics, he loves American politics, he should have known that first thing you say is the thing everyone remembers. And it was like, it was immediately ridiculed, wasn't it? It was like, I don't know, I have nothing to add to this. I don't know what happened. And immediately everyone's going, you don't notice this is enormous amounts of money piling into your account.
And that was the stick that they beat him with,
Yeah, it was just wasn't very credible.
Yeah.
Maybe it was true. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you can not notice.
I was curious though.
I tell you, if 150 grand went into my account in the morning, I would see, everyone would notice it. My boss would notice it because I wouldn't be in work. My missus would notice it.
I'd notice it because you wouldn't be here.
You know, the car dealer up the road would notice it because I'd be buying a brand new car. No, do you know what I'm saying? Like, a
you're
lot of people would notice
cash
it.
That day.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, but
before somebody realises this is a terrible error.
It's like Goodfellas. Remember the Goodfellas? You were saying, like, don't act like you've got loads of money. We'll have the mink coating on.
Big sheepskin coat on the middle of June.
Now, by the way, I think it kind of works out very well for Ryan Turbitt in the end, because he kind of had done everything he possibly could in RT. I mean, if he just continues on there, people may have got sick of him anyway, whereas now he's got this whole new start in London and he seems to be enjoying himself.
Curious to find out, has he been in touch with you or anything like that about the show to say good luck
I don't think he's in touch with anyone in RT. No, at the same time, I'm not texting him going, hi, are you okay? Can we meet up? You're in a different country now. Oh, well. Yeah. And I have your old job. This is awkward.
It's like texting someone, look, I'm going out with your board now. I know you are finished now, aren't you?
It's kind of like that Spice Girls song now at the minute, because you and Paddy Kilty, it's like two become one. Like, you get a job, Paddy gets a job.
It took two of us to replace him in the end. And it's one of those kind of lessons I think all of us who broadcast anywhere should remember. A bit like Jerry Ryan, when he died, you're kind of going, how can the station go on without this huge it's going to die, and it's the whole organisation going to die, and it just carries
on. It just does.
Just a number.
And I remember asking the day after they announced that Ryan was coming back, I asked the one of the people who were involved in the reception and what the switchboard, and I said, oh my God, did you get lots of complaints? There were lots of angry people in both directions ringing. And she said, no, there was just nothing.
Wow.
There was just no response. And I went, oh my God, that's kind of amazing. Just the finality of it meant that, okay, we're all ready to go now and just carry on. And then it's going to be, for all of us, Marion Finucane dying while still a broadcaster. And that was pretty shocking as well. And it was particularly sad for her because she was coming up to her 70th birthday. And she'd done so much in broadcasting, particularly getting women's voices out there and so on. And she didn't get to enjoy her retirement after all that work and toil.
I have a great story about Marion Finucane. I was asked to do...
don't tell him that one.
I was asked him on a radio show one time, and I had to review a book, and I think I was in Fair City at the time, but I didn't get a chance to read the book. So I went in on the show, and there were all these academics on the panel. There was like four or five of them, like, you know, from UCC, UCD, DCU, and Eric from Fair City, from FC, right? And I'm sitting there, and on the way, I mean, Mrs. Neil, and she says, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know, we'll fucking Google some reviews or something, right? So Googled a few reviews and picked out a few sentences, like, you know. She asked me about the book, and I went, well, blah, 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 and blah, 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 blah. And she was like, okay, right, that's great, that's great. And she turned to a woman from UCC who was sitting beside me going, and you read it too. And she was like, well, there isn't much more I can add to it, to what Eric's just said. I mean, Mrs. texted me going, I don't know how you did that. I know you didn't read it, but you convinced me that you read it. It was so good.
They went and bought the book.
Straight away, you'll be thinking, she read the fucking reviews as well.
Yeah. But no, she just looked like he's after really covering it well there. There isn't an awful lot I can add to that.
One of my favourite impressions, by the way, Marion Finucane, because I think the best way an impression works is when a voice comes out of a face that you don't expect. So, hello there, and a very good morning to you. And she used to kind of go up high like that and then sometimes finish nice and low. Eric Lawler there. Right. And it only occurred to me recently because we had Graham Norton on the show this morning and I was building up to this interview and I was going, nobody ever really seems to do this hugely well-known broadcaster in terms of all the impressions.
True, yeah.
No one ever thinks to do Graham Norton. And then as I started to do Graham, and I'm thinking, my God, he just sounded a little bit like Marion Finucane.
He does. Oh my God, he does. How did you say it?
The only difference being the laugh. He kind of does. Sometimes he talks and laughs at the same time.
He laughs, he coughs.
He, did you have him in live or was he on the phone?
Yeah, you know, he came in live at studio for a whole hour. Yeah, he's the nicest man. He's exactly the same.
I believe,
the first time I've ever met him. And he had a lovely little compliment before we went on air, which is very encouraging. I felt it was very like Jim Gavin, you know, the Dublin manager, because he was always very subtle with his encouragement. And because I remember I was Jim Gavin'd once and I did some gig and kind of just before... He sort of goes, I really love your stuff. I think you're amazing what you're doing. You're doing a fantastic job. I'm going, Gavin doesn't hear Callan's Kicks. I'm like, okay. Yeah. I was like, I felt really on cloud nine and I did the whole thing. And then I met some other people afterwards and said, oh my God, Jim Gavin is the loveliest man. He came up to me and he said, I love what you're doing. It was the kind of same thing. And Conor Moore, the comedian, tells a story about how Jim Gavin came up. He performed in front of the Dublin team, and I think we were in New York or something on their team holiday. And Conor Moore felt, oh my God, that kind of died in his arse. And he goes into the dressing room, and Jim Gavin comes in and says, absolutely amazing, the lads loved every bit of it, it's one of the best gigs they've ever seen, it's fantastic. Conor went home amazed, and then he met a Dublin player some months later and they said, oh, that was a disaster, Jesus. You should cry yourself to sleep that night. And Jim recognised this was a disaster and this young fella needs a bit of a lift.
He's a good soul.
Isn't he?
Here's another story now.
That's
I did a gig, he won all them. He's genius.
Yeah.
But this is it. Jim Gavin, I did a gig for the Dublin squad as well. And Jim Gavin, Bernard Dunne was on the background team, so he booked me for it. And they were doing their train, finished a training session. So I went down and I thought I'd be in a hall with a microphone. He says, and Jim came, it was like a military operation, Oliver. I had to wait at some spot. Yeah. Jim will see you now in a few minutes. And I was like, Jesus, stand there, you know. And then Jim walks down and he goes, how are you doing? Nice to meet you. And he brought me on the dressing room tour and he had all these pictures of old Dublin legends on the wall. This is, we try and inspire the boys about our heritage and all that. And the gourmet food pad, our big spread for all the boys.
Oh, lovely, yeah,
and the lads came out in their showers then and I was like, okay, right, where are we doing the gig? And it was on the grass hill. So the squad sat on the grass hill and I was at the bottom of the hill going, you want me to do it here? They're going, yeah.
Nightmare scenario.
Oh, but fairness, I knew some of the Dublin players. I knew Philly, obviously, you know, yeah. and a couple of the lads. Yeah. And they realised how tough it was for me. So they were like, ha, 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 giving
them
all.
At that.
You know,
yeah,
fair
yeah,
play
yeah.
to them, like, you know.
Brilliant.
But one thing I used in the gig, which went my way, was I saw Jim doing an interview with the Sunday game a few weeks prior to that. They'd beaten Westmead by about 400 points. And he went, you know, Westmead, they're a good side, they're an up and coming team, we got the bounce of the ball today, you know. So I used that as one of my opening jokes was, I went, I'm delighted Jim is here witnessing this gig, because no matter how bad this gig is going to be, he's going to say I was one of the top comedians in the country. And, they all knew, they all went, yeah,
exactly, that was the thing. Yeah. He was like purposely really dull in his interviews, wasn't he?
Yes.
He didn't want to make anything interesting in interviews, or else he'd have to do more of them.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That was the whole reason.
And what a fascinating man. I wouldn't like to be bollocked by Jim Gavin, though.
No, imagine him losing it.
Oh, my God.
Isn't he in charge of that Citizens Assembly or something? Or he's one of the main...
Yeah, he was involved in that. The Citizens Assembly on drugs, was it?
Yeah.
Well, was he on drugs when he's on it?
That's why he was so subdued in the interview.
Apart from the HSE. Great character, isn't it?
Just one final question I want to ask you all before we go. Do you enjoy the show? Are you enjoying it now?
I do. And it's a strange thing because of the circumstances we discussed, how I ended up there. And it was one of those things where, oh God, I kind of don't want to do it because I feel I worry what I might do to comedy. And I was geeing up for a tour this year, in fact, and I was trying to make that decision during that July-August period. It was like, this opportunity probably won't ever come up again, so you just have to do it. You can always get out of it if you don't want, because we haven't exactly... it's a very short marriage. It was a two-year contract, because I announced it straight away to everyone. Otherwise, those questions would have gone
transparent,
on.
Good man.
Transparent. And also announcing that it was much less than everybody else is on, but also more than... It's still a ridiculous amount of money. And I weirdly am enjoying it. I think I've learned so much more about the country than I would have had I not do it. Because you just get to meet extraordinary people. And we have a laugh a lot of the time, but then you meet these incredible women. For some reason, this year has become a theme where there's been very high profile court cases involving women being abused, either randomly or in a domestic violence situation. And they waive their rights to have the conversation.
Yeah.
And when you meet them, they're the most nervous I am for an interview, because you're going, they're not public figures. They only want to do this because they heard this similar interview somewhere years ago and they got out of domestic violence. We met Maeve O'Loughlin Doyle, whose husband was a guard. She had 12 years of abuse in her home. And her story is just phenomenal.
Horrific,
And like, we know that it's bad for a difficult for a woman to get out of the situation, but if their tormentor is a guard, you're feeling no one's coming to help you. And he knew this as well. And she told an extraordinary story, and she would very casually describe the violence because it was so, you know, mundane and everyday and
regular.
To her. She'd go, and I ended up on the floor, and that was the day, I think I broke my collarbone or chipped tooth or something.
Wow.
Like that. But I think it was the stuff where she talked about, when I'm cooking for the kids, he would go close enough to me at the cooker, talking about the weather or what his day was, that he knew I was edging away from him until I burnt myself on the frying pan or whatever. Like, it was such a description of terror in a household from a guy revered in his community, you know, kind of in all of his volunteers.
Did he end up getting a sentence?
He did, yeah. He was jailed, quite a severe sentence. I think 9-10 years, something like that, when some of it suspended and so on. But for her to tell that story and to get through all of the shame and everything, because people automatically will always ask women, well, why didn't you just say something in the first time you're beaten? And like, it's so incremental. They don't yeah. know they're in a trap until
you always think, totally, you know what trapped. It is? You always think it's going to change, and you always hope
yeah.
that it's going to change. I know I'm speaking from a child that came from a domestic violent mother and father relationship at home. And you're thinking, I know for me, when I seen my mother been physically beaten by my father and been abused by my father, and unfortunately my father and my mother aren't here, not in a sense to kind of defend themselves, but it's horrible. And you think that every time it happens that maybe it's not going to happen tomorrow, but it doesn't. And the only thing that my mom done, what a lot of them women done, was just left the home, just got away from it, like.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? And you can understand that. And then I kind of looked back into the piece of why my father done that. And when I looked back at why my father done that and where he came from and the childhood that he had been brought up, it was the only kind of way that he had of dealing yeah. with what he dealt with as a kid.
You know? So I suppose the long answer is that it's a kind of a, you feel in a sort of a privileged position because you're learning so much about the country, because that Ireland I described, that is the real Ireland that exists. You know, we celebrate St. Patrick's Day, oh, great to be Irish and so on, but there's different strata to it. And actually, Roddy Doyle is another conversation we're going to have in the next couple of weeks, because he's written another book, The Women Behind the Door, because famously Paula Spencer was the woman who walked into the doors.
Yeah, I saw that play. Yeah. Great. Yeah.
So he's kind of tying up the conversation. This Paula Spencer's now in her 60s, and it's 30 years since Family. Remember the programme?
Yeah,
yeah,
it was an extra.
You were in Ballymore.
Yeah, I was in it with Nelly O'Connor.
Nelly O'Connor.
Nelly was
yes,
in it. Yeah,
I was
Nelly
in it. Conroy.
Nelly Conroy.
And,
sorry,
Sean McGinley,
yeah.
Gerard Ryan, and Barry Ward is the kid.
Yeah, a lot of it was filmed in Ballymore. It was filmed in the courts and Pompton.
It was a huge production by the BBC, and it looks spectacular. And we're hoping.
Charlo
is the guy. And he is a chilling character, but he's also really cool when he's out in the street.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's kind of like, he's charismatic.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of, there was a conversation. And that erupted a huge story in Ireland in 1994. And Roddy was talking to us about that, because he was like top of his game. He was been asked to do all sorts of celebrity things. And then the minute that broadcast, it all stopped. And he was getting death threats. His mother is pushed in the supermarket by a woman she knows all her life down the road. And I don't remember that, because we had a sort of a 30-year celebration for Riverdance, and Ireland was becoming modern because we had USA 94 World Cup. We had an IRA ceasefire. It was all the hopeful of modernising the divorce referendum.
Clinton was here and all that. Yeah,
but I had forgotten that Family was that year too, and there was that raucous conversation. Yeah. And like, that's true Ireland. Spoke to some hippies who were running a sober pagan festival in Cavan. Do you know, that's also a strata of Ireland we forget about. I tried to cover as much of the north as I can, because sometimes I feel like the Orty, which was seen as kind of D4 heads for so long. I'm from Monaghan, so we see the north.
Yeah.
And we wonder why it's not being mentioned. And it's annoying because we have to read out a different text number for northerners.
So it sounds to me you're getting really excited about the role now, and where it can go and what you can do with it, and the responsibility you almost have in the role.
There's definitely responsibility, because you kind of, and I got this as a stand-in when I was filling in for Ryan. I'm going to go, yeah, that show is far too safe. They're going to come in with Edge and it's going to be doing this. And then suddenly you realise, oh no, if you say something, if you do that thing, you're going to create a pain for the lovely people who work on the team who have to answer and to sit down for hours writing out answers to official complaints. And RT, being the state broadcaster, attracts 85% of all the broadcast complaints, and they have to be replied to. Jeez. And you have to do transcripts of the show. And often it means that a couple of cranks can kind of control the editorial guidelines, whereas, you know, we're competing against social media where you can write anything you like.
Yeah.
Racism, not even casual, outwardly. You could organise a riot online and it'll still be there, and it makes money for that company. And we have those conversations as well about social media, because it drives me mad that all the politicians we're talking about, it's terrible, we're getting dreadful abuse, which is awful, but they are legislators who could do something about it.
100%.
And they have decided not to regulate these gigantic billion-dollar firms that are amidst us and are changing our world in terms of undermining democracy, undermining our even ability to discern what's real. Do you know, you don't know what's true anymore
in this new age of AI and everything that we have. What is real, what is fake, deep fake news and all that kind of shit. Listen, we could talk all day.
And then I should say the radio show is fun as well.
Oh, it is. Come here. And I can testify that it was real fun when I was on your show, Oliver.
You
remember that? That was a great day.
And are you still climbing the walls?
I went back to the two lads.
My God.
You had a great time. Yeah.
I always like the things a visiting critic does. We get a critic to come in and do something outside of their comfort zone. You're next, obviously.
I'd love to. Come here.
What is
outside Will's comfort zone?
That you would never like to do, that you think is a nightmare.
What do you not like doing, Willie?
What do I not like them?
Yeah, so they put me, he said, what's outside your cup? And I my first thing was, I hate musicals. So I thought they were going to send me to a musical.
I'm going to tell you what's in my comfort zone, and it's something, and I'm probably just throwing myself under a bus here, and it might cost you a few quid.
Jumping under a bus, you know,
going on a cruise, right? No.
For 2 weeks.
In the Caribbean, right?
I'd hate all that.
Inclusive.
Very good. Very
all
good.
Inclusive, right? That'd kill me. Now, I'll tell you what, we haven't got the budget, we're missing a few quid. Even though I walk at heights on a scaffolder,
yeah,
I sometimes am not afraid of heights, but jumping out of an airplane is totally on my
parachutes. Yeah.
What about being in a small plane, vintage plane? Oh,
yeah. No, that wouldn't really bother me. No, it's just, come here, there's a few things that I kind of...
he's going to give us a list.
No, there is, like, but that kind of is very fearful. Where did you go? You went to Orson Welles,
Yeah. I gave them a great marketing. I thought Orson Welles was a play on Orson Welles, and I said it to him, was Orson Welles a play on Orson Welles? He went, no.
It's actually very popular at the moment.
It's hugely popular, especially in the Olympics.
And it's all a social thing. They're all hanging out, aren't they? Drink coffee, chat.
That man said he meets all his friends through climbing.
It takes it to a new level now when you say my partner's driving me up the walls and climbing the walls.
Yeah, I'd be climbing the walls.
No, do you know, come here, let you think up something. And if I'm not comfortable, I'd love to come on the programme, definitely. Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
There we go, we're scratching each other's backs here. The good old crony way.
The circle jerk is now over.
Yeah.
Oliver Callan, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you
really
so much for joining us.
I shouldn't sound so surprised.
No. And you know what? It was effortless. And as we said in the beginning, look, there's no script, there's no nothing. We just kick it off and see wherever the ball goes. And it's been a pleasure having you on, I have to say.
I've been watching some of them because sometimes you listen to podcasts, but this one is worth watching, I think. Because,
thank you.
The guests end up looking over here and go, what's he saying next? What's he going to say next?
Thanks very much, Oliver. And good luck with all your future endeavours.
Cheers. Thanks.